From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Jory Lewis, whose new nonfiction book is Slaves for Peanuts, published by the New Press. Jory Lewis is an award-winning journalist who writes about agriculture and the environment. Her reports have appeared on PRI's The World and in Discovery Magazine, Pacific Standard, and the Virginia Quarterly Review. She's also a contributing editor of ADI, a literary magazine about global politics. In 2018, she received the prestigious Whiting Grant for Creative Nonfiction. Lewis splits her time between Illinois and Senegal. Here's a little information about Slaves for Peanuts, which is Jory Lewis's first book. Americans consume over 1.5 billion pounds of peanut products every year, but few of us know the peanut's tumultuous history or its intimate connection to slavery and freedom. Lyrical and powerful Slaves for Peanuts weaves together the natural and human history of a crop that transformed the lives of millions. Author Jory Lewis reveals how demand for peanut oil in Europe ensured that slavery in Africa would persist well into the 20th century, long after the European powers had officially banned it in the territories they controlled. Delving deep into West African and European archives, Lewis recreates a world on the coast of Africa that is breathtakingly real and unlike anything modern readers have experienced. Slaves for Peanuts is told through the eyes of a set of richly detailed characters, from an African-born French missionary harboring runaway slaves to the leader of a Wolof state navigating the politics of French imperialism, who challenge our most basic assumptions of the motives and people who supported human bondage. My interview with Jory begins with me first asking my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You mentioned at the beginning that your great-grandfather grew peanuts in Arkansas, but it doesn't sound like that was a real motivating force for you. That was almost sort of like an interesting fact about your life. What drew you to this story originally?
Yeah, you know, I wrote that that prologue. I think it was the last thing I'd written. My editor sort of asked me to kind of make sense of this interest, and I had this like memory that we used to grow peanuts on the farm. You know, or not we, but like the extended family. When I asked my father, he was like, "No, Jory, that was, you know, my grandfather grew peanuts, but." You know, like by the time you were born, no, there were no peanuts, but we were just buying them. So, but there was a kind of false memory for me somehow about like the peanuts on the farm.
Oh, interesting.
But yes, how did it get into the story? Well, you know, I was living in Senegal just in general. I had a kind of fellowship and I was looking at and writing about food security in the region, specifically Senegal, but also in I was also supposed to, it was envisioned that I would go to other places. But, and of course, if you're looking at the rural economy of Senegal, peanuts are still really important. And yeah, I mean, it's just the most, you know, I would venture to say it's probably still the most important crop in Senegal. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's how I got interested in peanuts, just because the context meant, you know, I was a journalist looking at a rural economy and agriculture in Senegal, and you would have to look at peanuts.
Right.
You know?
It's such an incredible story that you tell. And I wondered how you found your way through the story. It sounds like the peanut was sort of the natural course to follow, and the slave trade was an associated narrative that, you know, I don't know, they are so intertwined. So how did you follow the threads?
Well, I'll say that, the book was always, even when I pitched it to an agent and then to publishers, it was called Slaves for Peanuts. And so like the slavery aspect was integral. I didn't want to just write a story about peanuts that
sure
wasn't broad or rich enough for me. And yeah, the kind of initial motivation I sort of describe in the prologue about having this, you know, spending a lot of time in the peanut basin of Senegal, the peanut growing regions, and having this you know, at the time, like really striking encounter where I sort of understood, I guess I can tell that story more completely, is that I had a, you know, I was spending a lot of time in the peanut basin because that's what I did. And I had an ex-boyfriend, a future ex-boyfriend.
I liked that you said he was your future ex-boyfriend.
Who was always destined, yeah, right, you know. But he was an agronomist working in a number of villages in the region. In one village where he was working, where I'd met a number of the farmers, they were creating a kind of collective to grow different kinds of crops off season. So peanuts were grown only during the rainy season, which is short, but they could grow other things like, you know, vegetables for, you know, have market gardens and sell them in the cities for a lot of money, you know. And so this was their project. But the person they were kind of thinking about who should be the leader of the collective, and the person who it was really obvious to future ex-boyfriend and to me that who should be the leader of the collective was excluded because he was a descendant of formerly enslaved people. And so for me, that was just a kind of a moment where it sort of clicked for me. Like, of course, I knew there had been slavery in Senegal. And of course, I knew that, you know, maybe, you know, not only related to the transatlantic trade, but a kind of, you know, a system of domestic enslavement that maybe existed for a long period of time. So I, you know, it wasn't unusual, but it was for me this question of the stigma that still sort of touched and molded the lives of people that sort of started me on this journey. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I did later write an essay kind of about this, this sort of discovery about the stigma about slavery still sort of attaching itself to people in Senegal. So I could, you know, I could have continued to write a kind of reportage in the present day, but I wanted to look back to history and understand, like, more completely, to be able to sort of tell a story about, like, how these sort of conditions arose, mm-hmm. Not only about enslavement, but about the primacy of the peanut, about colonialism and, you know, conquest, all those things.
Yeah. Early on, you mention in the book, writing a historical narrative about the enslaved is complicated because there are multiple layers of silences. And then later in the book, you write, the writer who depends on voices from the archives is often disappointed. I felt like those were sort of related thoughts. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about how difficult it is to research a book like this, and what, you know, what's an example possibly of where you kind of came up against something that you had to then figure out how to work around?
Yeah, absolutely. And I realize now that I didn't fully answer your question about the interweaving of the narrative. So there is also a reason I definitely did. So the peanut, I envisioned the peanut as a character. And then the character, so the three principal characters, the peanut is one. We embody the peanut. We live with the peanut. And then the other is Latjor, the Damel or the king of Kajor. And the third is Walter Taylor, a Protestant missionary who establishes this shelter for runaway slaves. Mm-hmm. So the evolution of the work of the book, except for the peanut was always a character, but the two, Latjor and Walter Taylor, were not originally necessarily a part of the book, right? So I, you know, originally, I think when I first wrote the book proposal, I had a cast of different types of characters. But when I started to really delve into the archives, I was limited by the amount of material there was. Because this book isn't a typical history, it is a narrative history. Mm-hmm. So you need a lot of documentation just for like interstitial things, right? Just to drive the narrative forward, some points of interest. You just need more stuff, right? You know?
Yeah.
So Walter Taylor, when I discovered that, Walter Taylor was not at all on my radar until I was reading another book, and this other historian who doesn't necessarily write about slavery, but was writing about 19th century Senegal, wrote that there was a Protestant missionary who was from Sierra Leone. So it's like, oh, a Black missionary in the 19th century, that's already unusual. You know, that he, I think she also had mentioned that he was a Mason, and I was like, that is also a little unusual. Yeah. You know, so yeah. I had all these things that I was like, oh, this guy sounds really interesting. And then I kind of went down a rabbit hole, and I discovered, I first discovered the kind of reports from the Shelter for Runaway Slaves. They had like a kind of yearly newsletter to their donors.
Okay.
And then I was like, well, you know what? I wonder if there is correspondence, like literally just like day-to-day correspondence. And I went to the France, the Protestant mission still has archives. It's still in the same building it was like by the end of the 19th century.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. But,
not where Walter Taylor went. It moves later in the 19th century, but it's still there, right?
And right.
I think it's in the fifth. But but yeah, and so they had their archives. So I went there and I found, yeah, that there were 20 years, basically 20 years of correspondence about usually at least once a month, sometimes twice. And so, yeah, I mean, that became the kind of basis of the work. And for me, so one reason to focus on Taylor was twofold. One, that he had this very important shelter for runaway slaves, which is also just mind-boggling as an American. It's a thing you don't imagine finding on the African continent.
Right.
So that it was also kind of why I immediately was interested in it. And then two, you know, in a way, Walter Taylor, because back to your original question, it's because we do not have good sources about the enslaved or newly freed themselves, that Walter Taylor then becomes our way into the lives of those both enslaved and newly freed, right? So he almost like, in a way, stands in for them. I wouldn't say completely stands in, but it's almost, because, you know, I tried as much as possible. So I think with the line that you point out, that, yeah, the author who depends on the archives may be disappointed sometimes that there are just times where you would expect to find some piece of connecting evidence or commentary, and it's just not there, or just more information about a particular person, and you can't find it. I think I talk about in one chapter this man Samba Kumba, who I tried to find out more information about, but it's, you know, very difficult, even though he was in a more subordinate position to the mission. And yeah, he worked for the mission for also, I think, 20 or 30 years, but there's just very little information about him. So, you know, these things, they're especially the less power you have, the less sort of like traces in the archive
record, yeah,
that you will have also, right? So that, you know, the records are just popping up small little sentences in newspapers or some type of administrative record or court records, and that's all you can really depend on.
Yeah.
In a way that it's heartbreaking, in a way, really, that you can't always recover those histories. So the mission is interesting too, just because of its kind of propaganda, you know, for evangelization. It's taking down, at least in rudimentary ways, a number of slave narratives, which isn't common in Africa, right?
Right.
And so that's another reason to kind of look at them.
Right. And it was interesting to me that you included, I mean, you really kind of gave us such a full picture of every aspect of this story. So when it comes to Walter Taylor, you go back and you show us a little bit about his parents and about his early years. And actually, there was a certain point where he was sort of well on his way to a fairly different professional life, and he was convicted of theft. He was accused of stealing a book, which sent him to prison for 3 months. And then, you know, his trajectory changes altogether. And that was really interesting. Thinking about you putting this story together was really impressive to me, you know, and then, you know, there's the peanut, and you talk about sort of how the peanut grows and where it grows best, but also a lot about the crop. So one of the reasons that peanuts became an important crop was the need for oil. And you talk a little bit about that and how, like, not just for dietary reasons, but for, you know, in the industrial age, you wrote that one thing all the machines needed was a little grease to help them run. So I know that you talk about the palm oil and sort of the transition, both for oil and soap, of going from olive oil to palm oil and eventually peanut oil. Did peanut oil come into play really quickly at some point?
Yeah, I would say it probably did come about relatively quickly. So, I mean, the uptick in demand for peanut oil, again, like as you say, it's related to the Industrial Revolution and sort of also expanding kind of hygiene, changes in hygiene.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I was reading that to my husband. I'm like, wait, listen.
Yeah, I mean, so people just didn't bathe very much and they're starting to bathe more, you know, in the common people, let's say. Like, this is already a kind of movement that I think the upper class is already starting to bathe more. And then now, like, commoners or whatever are bathing
right,
more.
Right, right. So
I think, you know, I mean, definitely the trajectory of the peanut, or like the peanuts exportation from West Africa, happens in phases. So I think I included, like, there's you know, this particular merchant in the Gambia who writes to this man who's writing a history of, I think it's the history of like the British colonies or something like that, the British Empire. And he talks about peanut oil, but he also talks about palm oil. So he's talking about all these different products that might be useful. He is himself, if I remember correctly, he's from Northern England and from an area that is, like, you know, pretty involved in industrialization at the time, you know, a lot of machines. So I think there's a relationship there. The French, it seems to be related, you know, the French are need more oil for soap, seems to be related to a series of frosts that killed olive trees across the Mediterranean. And so they needed more oil, and peanut oil has a very similar chemical composition as to olive oil. So I think there's, especially because of that need at the time, and because palm oil didn't quite fit because they didn't like the color, because it couldn't sell it, you know, peanut oil got to be sort of more the target for the French market. You know, and so then it just depended on their capacity to get enough peanuts, right? So I think that's kind of how it happened. I think I can't remember right now, like, what the ramp up was. It took a little bit of time, you know? So, like, from the 1840s, say, to, like, you know, by the 1870s, it's quite a lot being grown and exported. But even, you know, from the 1840s to the 1850s, it's growing sort of exponentially.
And I didn't mean to pin you down about the data. It's like, you have so much in your book. I'm sure you can't remember every single statistic. I loved how you mentioned that. This is just a tiny little thing, but you were talking about the evolution of the peanut itself, the history and the crop. And the peanut, you wrote, may well have resulted, this is not a quote, but you said it may well have resulted from a single hybridization event. And then you translate this as a one night stand. That's pretty funny. So literally, like, once this happened, and then it's just such a healthy crop that it just continues and continues. And it seems to really like sandy soil, which is the soil of the region that you are writing about, the Jour of Kajur, I guess you called it.
Yeah, exactly.
So was it fun learning about the crop itself and sort of the way that it grows?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm, you know, I do write about agriculture mostly, and, you know, and the environment and conservation, all of those things. So, I thought it was a kind of challenge to kind of bring a treatment of the peanut as a character almost, and to engage in a kind of writing about the peanut that gives it a little bit of agency, and it makes it a little fun to read. Yeah, so I was totally interested in. I did a lot of research. I remember a friend, I ordered a book through a friend. You know, I was still in Senegal, and I was using someone's, like, diplomatic pouch, and it's this, like, huge dusty tome on, like, peanut science and technology. And she's like, "This has to be a mistake." I was like, "It's not. I need it." And, like, you know, so yeah, I definitely, you know, tried to learn as much as I could, even though I'm, you know, I am. You know, the secret is I have no, like, biology background, right?
So, oh, interesting.
So I'm always, I'm learning, maybe that that helps. I'm learning along with the readers also about how these things work.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. So one of the, this is a quote from the book. Is it okay if I read from the book? Is that all right?
Yeah.
One of the first regions to answer the call of the peanut was an area that traced the littoral from more than 600 miles from the Gambia to Liberia. You write that it wasn't maybe the best place soil-wise to grow the peanut, but it, and this is a quote, it had already established trading posts and crucially had a lot of labor, the arms and backs of thousands of enslaved people. And I really thought that that was a moment of sort of the coming together and the crux of this book. Obviously, you expand and broaden it a lot, but I wondered if slavery was associated at all with other crops in this way before the peanut, or if this was sort of uniquely responsible for the use of enslaved people in this way.
No, not at all. Yeah, in that particular region, in what they called the Southern Rivers, they were also initially, well, so that's a particularly interesting place. And actually, I think, you know, not very many people ask questions about this, so thank you for this.
Oh, good.
The Southern Rivers is, or the Southern or the Northern Rivers, depending on your perspective, is what is now basically Guinea-Bissau, Guinea, and like parts of Sierra Leone. And it's a region of mostly like mangrove forests and swamps, and there are all these kinds of small estuaries where you can kind of get lost and get lost in. So after the end of the transatlantic, you know, the legal transatlantic trade by the British and the Americans in 1807 or 1808, a number of Euro-Africans, in fact, a number of Americans and British men who then married local women, had a number of children that were then Euro-African, as they call them, mixed race children, who then also continued to trade in a kind of like clandestine slave trade. So this is a very unusual kind of piratey place, basically. They're just like outlaws,
right?
Like, depending on the fact that they live in a place where it's, they can kind of like get lost in the swamps essentially and evade controls. So those people are trading with areas in what's like the Guinea Highlands, the Fouta Jallon, and they're using their laborers to grow whatever crops. The peanuts become the crop that they start growing at presumably already like in the 1830s and the 1840s. But even before that, they were growing coffee.
Okay.
Actually, quite a lot of coffee. There's a varietal of coffee that was grown at the time in West Africa that's like as good as Arabica.
Oh, okay. Not
as grown anymore. But yeah, so that's what they were doing. But otherwise, yeah, so palm oil, that's a thing. Slave labor had been used for all kinds of things. I think in the book I mentioned that enslaved people are often like pounding millet. So a number of activities, not just peanuts.
Now, the mixed race aspect that you just were talking about reminds me of Niara Bailey. Is that how you say her name?
Niara Bailey.
So is she one of the people that is basically evading capture? And
she was like a power broker. She's like a chief basically at that point. So yeah, the story, her, you know, so this is also the secret that I wanted Niara Bailey. Because other people have asked me, why are there no women characters?
Right. I was wondering if she was one of the characters you were trying to tell more about.
I was trying, but there wasn't enough information about her, unfortunately. Even though, you know, some documents say like she'd gone to university in England and like, but yeah, I don't know, you know, where the letters she might have written. I have no idea. Right. Like, so it's just, you know, like, who knows where all that information went. But yeah, she's one of them, kind of an outlaw character, essentially. She's her husband, his name was Stiles Lightburn from South Carolina, who's apparently related to, I think, like a senator or someone in Congress anyway at the time, maybe a governor. Anyway, some politician.
You said at the time. I thought you meant now. I'm like, Nothing would surprise me.
There's probably still a South Carolina politician with links to Styles Leibert. And I don't count it out. But that's like basically their business. They have a lot of slaves. They are trafficking enslaved people. And when they can't, they're using them as labor. So, you know, over time, like maybe that shifts, maybe as the trafficking is less lucrative, maybe there are fewer enslaved people being bought, being used, you know, mm-hmm. So there's this, but yeah, at the end of her life, she's kind of like a chief and power broker in the region.
Okay. Now, a lot of your book centers on the French colonial government and its effect on this whole story. The governments that it replaced were run by elected officials. You've already mentioned this, I think. Damels, is that how you say it?
Well, so Damel is not, I mean, he's elected in a way, but it's more, you know, I kind of think about it like the way that Saudi Arabia goes about it, you know, so like how the Saudi Arabia, there are a number of people who could basically be king, but there's a kind of in the leadership that decides, there are factions. So that's basically what the Damel is.
Okay.
It's kind of elected, but not by the people, only by a kind of aristocracy.
Oh, okay. All right. But they seemed very important, and it seemed like that was sort of one of the biggest obstacles for the French was getting rid of these local leaders. I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about who these rulers were.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the Senegal and all of West Africa had sort of socio-political structures, right? So that, Senegal in general, what we now call Senegal, is a series of, I actually don't remember how many, but several kingdoms. Yeah. At some point, they were a part of an empire, the Jolof Empire. At some point, the Jolof Empire was also like, had a kind of relationship to the larger empire, the Mali Empire. So like, they're all kind of related. There are these structures, there are states, they break down, they reform like any place, right? Like in Europe, you know, Europe at the time, actually, but especially more like maybe Europe 300 years before or something, right?
Sure.
So there are a number of different places. So Cajour is a kingdom. It's and the Damel is its leader. He's a king, you know. And the French, it's hard to say like what the motivations of the French are at the beginning of this period. You know, I always like to point out that France in the 19th century is going through an enormous amount of upheaval itself, mm-hmm. right? So there are how many revolutions? I actually can't remember right now, but several.
Yeah, you know, big ones. Like, you know, big ones.
Right, big ones. Big ones, right? Like the state overturns itself. It's like, yeah, revolution, then empire, then republic again, and then, you know, so it's like back and forth. It's just like an enormous amount of upheaval and war with neighboring states, with Prussia, with England, with whatever, you know. So there's a kind of limited appetite for colonial expansion at first. That later changes throughout the century. So with that appetite for colonial expansion, once it starts, the Damel and Cajour, so like the names of the rulers of each kingdom changes. So Cajour has Damels, mm-hmm. right? You know, then I forgot, like in Baol, they have the ruler is called the Ken. And then, yeah, they all have different names. There's like the Burr.
Are they all speaking different languages too, or?
Yeah, some, but mostly Wolof. So they're the like quote unquote Wolof states.
Wolof states,
like
right.
The Wallow and like Cajour and Baol to some extent. Baol also has a lot of Serer speaking people, and then there are Serer speaking people in the Sin and the Saloum, and then in the north, the Futatoro, they're speaking Pular. Yeah, so a number of different languages.
Great. So one of the main Damels in your story is one of the other characters who you follow closely, and that's Latjour. I'm not going to say it right.
Latjour Ngoni Latjour Diop. But Latjour Diop.
Okay. So you know, without maybe going super deep into the story, but I mean, he was a very, it sounds like he was a very competent leader, and he gave the French a run for their money, which was interesting to me. Can you just talk a little bit about how you found him and why he is important to your story, how you chose him to be one of the characters that would carry this story?
I mean, Latjoie is a kind of Senegalese national hero. He's an extraordinary sort of ruler in the kind of pantheon of Senegalese heroes, right? So there's a fountain in Dakar of the supposed horse of Latjoie, right? So Latjoie is like, you know, he's well known. He's not like, okay. It was like
It's not like Mr. Taylor, who you found by accident.
No, he's like George Washington or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's not, you know, like, he's not a obscure person.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Like, you know.
Gotcha.
Latjoie, I mean, he's an interesting character. I went through many iterations of different types of feelings about Latjoie personally.
You
know?
Right.
Which, you know, maybe are reflected in the book. You've kind of have a kind of... Yeah, of course, it's interesting, his relationship to the French. It's not just that he gives the French a run for their money, but that he's often collaborating with them, negotiating with them.
Right.
That he has a kind of strategic approach to power in the region. So there are a number of things about Latjoie that are interesting. But, I was learning about Latjoie, and what was interesting to me at first about him was the fact that there are these really interesting letters in the archive of him asking for his slaves back. So it's like, well, what is this all about? Like, why is this happening? You know, what does it mean? So all of that kind of helped sort of start me on the path.
Okay. I think I said that about giving them a run for their money specifically because this one battle that you describe where I think it was him. It kind of tricks them into an area where they're surrounded on all sides by thorny bushes. And I might be conflating things. Sorry. Never mind.
He has several battles. I think there's one early on that I talk about where Latjoie is. What is happening? I can't actually remember now. I'm forgetting. But yeah, I know what battle you're talking about where they win in this particular case. And then I think later, lose later. But he's a... He's a sort of keen strategist also with his advisors.
Yeah. I did want to ask you to read a section because I don't want to forget or neglect to mention that your prose is just beautiful. And this one section, it's very short, but it brought to mind two different questions. So I wonder if you'd mind reading the one that we talked about before.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. While Cobb and Butman persisted in the African trade, the named agents and ship captains may have been aided by the unnamed Walter Taylor, clerk and accountant, whose thankless job made their business run. He said he accepted the proposition to come to Gorée because he wanted to improve his French in Wolof, on an island where those were the two main languages. A strange thing, he said. I started learning the languages by myself, just to distract myself at the age of 19. Both languages were necessary in a region where, along much of the coast and into the interior, French was the main administrative language, and most small traders were forced to use Wolof, since it was the most common language in the nearby peanut-growing lands of Cajour and Bawol. Since the island was so small, the buildings on Gorée were typically multi-purpose compounds. Many were equally storehouses for peanuts, animal skins, or tobacco, boarding houses for visitors from faraway lands, bars with the most popular firewaters from gin and rum to port and absinthe, textile shops and haberdasheries selling cloth by the yard, pharmacies stocked with quinine for the fevers, bookshops offering maps and almanacs, listing the high tides at the main ports of call, grocers with rice or millet, dried meat, and tinned vegetables for the people making those trips, and brothels too, of course.
Thanks. Thank you for reading that. So, like I said, I just wanted to mention that the prose is so beautiful and very detailed and very, you know, evocative of the setting and the sort of bustling life of this place. I wanted to ask a little bit about both filling in detail in obviously a place and time that you've never been and sort of figuring out how to deliver us there as well as you do. And also, you know, I think early on you write something about how it might have gone this way for him, you know, and I wondered, you know, how it was for you filling in a narrative where you sometimes weren't quite sure, but you sort of thought this is very likely that this is how his life unfolded right in this moment and writing from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, so just in general, the kind of filling in all the details in general, like I have the archival works, but I also read basically every other historian's book on this period.
Okay. You know? Yeah.
And then I read newspapers and I looked at photos, local archival photos. What else? Yeah. I had novels sometimes too, although less so. Just because, you know, like who knows what their details are coming from, you know, PhD dissertations, just like everything.
Right.
Know?
Right. Sure.
Like a really broad sweep of information. So that's mostly what I would use to kind of create the world, especially like, I guess, especially say like newspapers, magazines, that kind of stuff. Occasionally, even from the letters of, like, say, Walter Taylor, but especially he has some other colleagues. Another colleague I mentioned in the book, George Golaz, wrote 20-page letters.
Oh,
and
wow.
Just like he was so inspired by the environment, and he gave such great descriptions of the town that he was staying. So I used maybe some of those descriptions, even in places where George Golaz wasn't yet there, right? Because he was like a good person to just describe what was happening around in that particular time period in the 1880s, which is when he was there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, even some documents that don't appear in the book, I think, from others, say you're still using these mission records. The mission records are really valuable because they're often like when a fresh missionary would come, he would write these like super detailed letters to like family or whatever. Well, mostly to the director, but like, who knows, you know, sometimes they were related to people on the board. So there are these kinds of a mix of a kind of purpose of the letter sometimes. And so I remember there was another particular missionary from the 1860s that I used some of his descriptions as well, just kind of picked up on his how he was seeing San Luis, for example. So I used a lot of that, like, to be honest. Some of this particular list that I just read is cobbled together also from, there are a number of kind of like account records in the archives. So like of different types of merchants on Goree and San Luis, especially in their wills.
Right.
Like when they passed, there would be like accountings of the goods in their shops.
Yes.
Right? So that also helped me put it together a little bit, like what these shops might have been like, what they would have looked like.
You had a little section called Lost and Found Ephemera that was kind of fun to read, and it sounds like a similar kind of thing that you uncovered that had information, but structurally it was kind of fun to run across that as well.
Yeah. I like those. Yeah. That was a little controversial. People are like, I don't get this. Like, why do you need this? It's like, well, I don't need it. That's the point, right? Like, I don't need it. It's just like, it's just kind of cool to know that there is this weird lost and found, and like they had bags of, you know, monkey bread seeds or whatever, you know, and like, and that's what good. They, you know, as they call them. Right. So.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you about books that you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners, if there are any that you would particularly, like just a couple or three maybe.
Sure. Yeah. I've been on a novel reading kick lately. So the last book I just finished was Akweke Emezi's The Death of Vivek Oji. I like that a lot. It was pretty good. I also, in the historical fiction, so maybe because readers of mine might actually also like historical fiction, I've been reading, or I just finished a couple weeks ago, The Matrix, Lauren Groff, which I loved.
Oh, yeah.
Like, really, really loved. and I'm trying to think, I was also just reading another historical fiction book. I don't know, how do I pronounce it? It's called, like, How Much of These Hills is Gold? What is her name? Her name is C. Pam Zhang.
Okay.
Maybe also Zhang, I'm not sure. Yeah, which is also a really lovely book about this kind of two Chinese sort of kids, actually. And, like, it's a mystery about, like, what's happened to their ma, like, they're in the West, like, around the time that the railroad's being built. So it's really interesting. Very evocative.
Wonderful. Thanks. Great. What about your own writing? I know that you're on a book tour right now, but are you working on anything new?
I am not. I need a break. You can understand. I feel like I spent a number of years on this book, and I almost feel like traumatized or something. Like, if you take on a project, it might also take another, like, decade of your life, you know?
Yeah.
What I mean?
Yeah, so
I'm just
absolutely
not ready.
Yeah, when you said I've been on a kick reading novels, I'm like, I bet. You
know? Yeah, you understand.
Okay, great. So I always like to finish these interviews by asking for advice for writers who might be listening, in your case, I was going to ask about advice for conducting research for a project that, you know, is enormous, like we were just talking about, and how much of your time and how much of your life went into this. But, you know, was it hard to manage all that you had to do? And so do you have any advice for that? Either just emotional advice or literally, like, research advice?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just, you know, be kind to yourself. It just takes, I think when you set out to write such an ambitious book, it takes a lot more time than you think it will, number one. You know,
yeah,
you will be unable to go faster. That's just what it is, you know. And so you just have to, yeah, take your time, be patient with yourself. I don't know. I mean, maybe also use some good tools to manage, especially, like, archival work. It's really difficult sometimes to manage the material.
Uh-huh.
I use Evernote. I don't know. Maybe other people use other things. Evernote's great just because it, you know, you can, you know, take the images, like, take pictures within the app, and then you can also, like, tag them and, you know, later search them. So that became the kind of architecture of my book, how I organized the research. But it was a lot. I mean, there was, you know, Evernote, there were spreadsheets also, because I had to, like, keep track.
Sure.
So I would take pictures of these archival documents, and then I would transcribe the documents, because otherwise you don't know what's in them. Right.
Yeah.
So then, yeah, I would have to keep notes about, like, that. You said the spreadsheet, you know, I write in Scrivener, which is also really helpful to organize my thoughts and also kind of keep all the material in one place. So I would take out portions and put them back. And, you know, Scrivener was really friendly in terms of doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing is maybe just broadening our field of vision. So there was also, I guess, one source that I didn't mention earlier is that I used oral histories, but also fables and oral traditions. So, like, epic poems, essentially. Like,
right,
I used
right.
all of those things.
Yes. Are these from the Griot?
Is that Griot?
Griot. Yeah. Griot.
Yeah, yeah. So there, yeah, in the case of Lat Jor, there are at least three versions of the Epic of Lat Jor. So, like,
that's
just
right,
reading
right.
all of those things together and kind of forming that kind of synthesis, it really makes it richer, I think, than depending on just, like, you know, a set of dry documents, but, like, also depending on, like, all the kind of, you know, let's call it, like, cultural remnants that you can find about the period, about the people.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Slaves for Peanuts by Jory Lewis, who's been my guest today, and it's published by the New Press. Jory, thank you so much for talking to me about this book. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you for having me.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Jory Lewis. Her book is Slaves for Peanuts, published by The New Press. You can learn more about her work at jorylewis.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Jory Lewis. If you're working on something and it's not moving along, try changing the perspective. And in doing this, keep in mind the way one focuses a camera. Focus in, pull out. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes, and there are over 500 unique interviews there. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. You can just subscribe to have them sent to your app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week. Often they have been suggested by my guests. So be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to social media at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.